3, 2, 1, go!
Welcome back, everybody, to the Triad of the Force podcast, a podcast from Puerto Rican friends coming together to do deep dives into Star Wars and other nerd-related media. We are talking about The Mandalorian, Chapter 19, The Convert. We're a little late, we know, we're sorry. And it's just the two of us, but there is a lot to digest in this episode. Yes. So I think it's still going to be an amazing conversation. What an episode. I think it's been the longest one so far.
It was. I think it was. And and the advantage though, is that it didn't feel that long, even though it was. And this is going to be a little prelude, right? Of like what we're going to discuss about the episode later, but it was a little Andor-esque in length. But in a good way,
and a little bit in tone too,
but we'll get to that. And it's always interesting because when we see Mandalorian episodes, they're usually like in the 20-minute, 30-minute range, and I'm always a little disappointed because I want, you know, just give me that HBO full hour type of thing. But I'm always surprised by like how good the writing has been, where they're able to like put so much story in so little time and be so efficient with the storytelling. But it was a breath of fresh air. There we go, my English.
To have a long ass episode.
To have a long ass episodes and a surprising episode, which some people, again, the discourse online.
You can never make Star Wars fans happy. They were complaining that it wasn't Andor enough, and then this episode was closer to an Andor type thing, and then they complained about it and called it filler. Which to me is completely insane. You got two amazing stories packed into one.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it was filler? Let's get spicy immediately. Let's go with the buzzwords. Nani, was this episode filler?
Not even close.
Why not? Why is the internet wrong? Educate us, please.
Well, one, the internet is usually wrong. So just get that out there. Okay. This was on the tail of the last episode where we found out that the Mythosaur is real. So this changes everybody's perception of pretty much everything that's going on. And we have the opening is like right after that happened. And Bo-Katan kept that fact to herself. Mm-hmm. She didn't say anything. It was surprising to me at the time, but in hindsight, it makes sense because that blew her mind. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can see all the bubbles like coming out of her helmet, like we discussed in the last episode, that this rocked her belief system. And she has been holding on to that belief system for a long time. And she's not willing to let that go, even though, you know, new evidence was presented. So she's kind of in this place where I'm pretty sure she's just holding all her chips close and trying to see where the wind takes her. So it makes sense. But the whole like interrogation with Din after everything happened, like, do you remember anything? No, I just remembered like
it was a fishing expedition for her. He's like, okay, let's see where this himbo's at, so I can know what cards to play in the future. Like, I don't know necessarily if she's doing it maliciously.
I don't think so. I think she's trying to protect herself and trying to see where things are going. Yeah.
Okay, because the discourse I've seen about it is two schools of thought, right? At this point.
Yeah.
One is that she, and it's the most prevalent one, is that she is lying to Din about what happened and like withholding the information about the Mythosaur because she wants to be the ruler of Mandalore.
Right. And she wants to use it to her advantage.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. She wants to manipulate the situation so that she may be that ruler. Although I do appreciate your nuanced take because I don't think I've heard enough people have that take. So why don't you elaborate on why you feel that she might be even protecting Din?
Well, because I feel like she's had many an opportunity to take advantage of Din if that's what she wanted. Like, he offered to give her the Darksaber. Obviously, she knows that it can't be given anymore as she failed spectacularly the first time that happened. But she had basically given up. She just went into Sanctuary. She hid away and she'd lost all hope. And even though there's this new opportunity to maybe retake that throne, I think maybe she's beyond that now. And it's more about finding that community again and finding her people again and getting beyond what has been happening. And she, I think, herself realizes in those conversations that she has with Din before the Mythosaur thing happens I think she recognizes in herself that she has become a cynic and that maybe that cynicism has been working against her. So I think ultimately she is on Din's side. It's just the fact that Din has been so indoctrinated that I don't think she trusts him enough to let him know all this information, because obviously he would have immediately just said, oh, the Mythosaur was there, the second coming of the Watch. And she doesn't necessarily want to empower the Watch, because it is, you know, Death Watch, and it has failed before. So I think it goes back to that conversation that we were having last time on the last episode, of that fine line between faith and taking it too far into a cult, and trying to see how to balance cynicism with myth and culture, and that faith bringing people together instead of separating them.
Right.
So I don't know. I wanna believe in Bo-Katan and hope that she has good intentions. But again, it can go either way, because as we saw from the other storyline that we had during this episode, there's a lot of manipulation, a lot of things that I weren't expecting, and like red herrings everywhere. So
exactly. But I wanted to piggyback on what you were saying about the cult, because then another big question that everyone is having, myself included, right, is Bo-Katan Kree of Clan Kree's, is she actually buying into the cult, or is she kind of keeping or reeling herself in as self-preservation so she can maybe, again, let's assume nothing right now. For the sake of argument, let's say that she is kind of using the Mythosaur secret to her advantage so that she can maybe use the legend so that she can supplant herself as the leader and like just play along so that then she can use their beliefs.
The connections that she's making now that supposedly she's atoned because she bathes in the living waters and hasn't removed her helmet since. So she's part of the creed now.
Right. But do you think it's self-serving in the sense that like she's playing the long con so that she can then manipulate them into joining?
Well, I think inherently there has to be something self-serving about actions in general, especially if you're going to be a leader, you have to be self-serving in something. I don't think she's doing it maliciously. I think she is trying to use it to maybe reach these people, like get the in and then kind of see what's going on within them, and then kind of get a following, and not necessarily for herself, but just for bringing unity to the Mandalorians that are left. So I want to think that it's not in a malicious intent to like supplant herself, but more of a kind of get in and try to break some of those stereotypes and maybe learn something herself as well, because as we've seen, her belief system has been shaken as well. So maybe she doesn't, I doubt she completely buys into it, but there's something now to this like Mythosaur myth, because
that's something that that's something that troubled me a little bit about this. I mean, and I don't mean to say it troubled me, and so I don't like the episode. I love the episode. But that whole thing of like, and obviously we will have a resolution to it. So everything I'm about to say might not even be true, but at least for now, the implication of everything seems to, at first glance, validate the cult. So it's just like, we have the legend of the Mythosaur that we were talking about. I don't know if it was.
And it's real.
I don't know if it was in Book of Boba Fett that the Armorer mentioned it, or in season 2 or 3, whatever.
Yeah.
The Armorer mentioned
it. But it had been mentioned,
So it's a prophetic thing of like the return of whoever dude that brings a new age of Mandalore with the Mythosaur and all that stuff. So all of a sudden we see the Mythosaur. So are the legends true? Is the way? So me as, you know, as a kind of like an anti-religious type of person and kind of anti-cult, you know, and we should all be anti-cult. Right. Even if you're in a religion, you should be an anti-cult. Because that type of programming is dangerous. But I don't know if I truly hope not, and I don't think they will. But for now, like my fear was just like, wait, is this show kind of validating the cult and being like, no, this is true, because like all their belief systems are actually being validated by the discovery of the Mythosaur. And I'm just like, if that's the approach, I'm just like, that's
scaring me when we had the conversation about the previous episode, because it just ended with, you know, the Mythosaur being real. But now we're getting a little bit more context into it. And I think it's not going to go in that direction. I hope it's not. Yeah. It's just kind of, I think she's going to use an in and maybe try to, because Din himself, even though obviously now he doesn't know about the Mythosaur, but he still believes in, you know, the living waters and all these things. But he's been having doubts about the Creed as well, mm-hmm. through his relationship with Grogu and through all the other people that he's met throughout his journey so far. So I think we're going to find more of a balance between the, you know, completely cynical, completely cult thing and kind of meet in the middle somewhere. But that's just my hopeful thinking. I have no idea where we're going.
And we'll see.
But I hope they don't continue to violate the cult. But right, we're going to see. I don't know.
Because what message does that send? He's like, okay, kids, well, Heaven's Gate was fine. Yeah. You know,
especially with the helmet thing that, you know, you're making a 12-year-old kid never reveal his face to other people. And then you have someone like Bo-Katan who thought the helmet thing was kind of a joke. And every time she saw Din, and she makes a joke in the episode as well. It's like, I would invite you to eat something, but I'm pretty sure that helmet's not coming off again. Mm-hmm, so she's kind of leaning into it to get that in.
Right. And the whole aspect too of the armor kind of being a troublesome figure for like how she is validating what she says, right? Because she has been told Din about the legend of the Dark Saber and what it means for the person that wins it in combat and all that stuff. But then she in a way kind of disrespects him, right? You know, because technically the way that she told Din the story of the Darksaber means that he is the rightful leader. of Mandalorians.
Yeah.
But then she doesn't treat him like a leader. She doesn't give him that respect. She always kind of has to put him down and finds ways to maintain her own power within the group. So,
she tries every time to discredit him as much as she can. So to me, she's a massive hypocrite, because why wouldn't you want the Darksaber, which is a very strong symbol of your own myth, to be on your side? Oh, because it's not completely under her control, which is why she discredited Din immediately after he lost the he won the duel. It's like, oh, you won, but have you removed your helmet? But it was like immediate.
Yeah, but like, let's find out, because I wouldn't be surprised if she takes off her helmet too. But because then it extends then to her questioning of his bathing in the waters. Because I think she knew that he could have. I think she knew that Mandalore is fine and that you can actually bathe in the waters. And it was a way for her to kind of manipulate.
Maintain control. Into
maintaining control and keep him as an apostate. Because if you're an apostate, even if you have the Darksaber, you can't be the leader. But then
you'll have no influence.
Mando, the himbo that he is, through dumb sheer luck, just keeps, you know, succeeding. Yeah. He's failing upwards, our dude here. And he was able to find the waters, able to bathe in it, find the Mythosaur, and then bring the evidence back. And I bet that the armor at every turn is just like, damn it, like I'm really trying to get rid of this
guy. To discredit him, and I just cannot. Right.
This is not the dude. This is not the dude that I want. And he just keeps coming back. And now he brought this other girl that I hate. It's like mean girls type of thing. It's like Regina George, and I forgot Lindsay Lohan's character. And it's Bo-Katan and the armor, and I think they're gonna get at it. But and our poor Pedro Pascal is right in the middle of it, and he's the Jon Snow of this show, right? He doesn't want to be. I don't want it, right? He doesn't want to be the next Mandalore. But
well, and now there's an extra added to Bo-Katan, because Bo-Katan had pretty much like kind of gone to sleep. Like, I'm done. I have my seclusion. I'm done. And then they blew up her home. Mm-hmm. It's like the stupidest thing they could have possibly done.
That was going to be my next question to you.
Yeah. As soon as it happened, I was like, that was such a stupid move.
It's a stupid. Well, you got to elevate the stakes. But this is the next question. I already mentioned that Din is kind of like Jon Snow, it seems to be, right, the hero that was promised type of thing, and he's going to be Mandalore. And Daenerys is Bo-Katan to an extent, where, like, Daenerys was the actual heir to the throne, and she's fighting to get it back. My question to you is, and this is going to be a spicy take, because I don't think anyone liked this twist in Game of Thrones Season 8, where Dany went a little...
ballistic.
A little cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs, is Bo-Katan gonna go Danny on us? What do you think?
Well, first, let's clarify that the actual heir to the throne was Jon Snow, not Daenerys. He was
tomato potato. You know what I mean?
He was first in line, so it's more legitimate.
That's true, but you know what I mean.
Just saying.
Okay, book and, nerd.
Yeah.
And I still have the show too. So you're
the Daenerys going completely ballistic makes sense. It just didn't make sense how they did it so quickly from one episode to another. True. But otherwise, if they would have taken a season or something to explore that, it would actually make sense that she eventually goes insane after all this pressure and everything that's happened in her life. And she is a daughter of the Mad King. So madness mm-hmm. runs in their veins as well. So the fact that that's how it ends wasn't surprising. It's just the way it was executed was absolutely terrible. You don't flip a switch like from one episode to another because they killed your servant lady. After they've murdered, you know, pretty much everybody else in your family, that's the one that makes you flip. I don't know. It was not well done. But I don't know. A lot of things have happened to Bo-Katan. I really don't want her to end up turning into the bad guy because I love her. But I mean, bad guys.
Especially when her wig is on point, finally.
Yeah. I know. But I mean, bad guys that are kind of right are very compelling. So I wouldn't be completely against it either. I mean, I would be like upset that if she becomes the bad guy and if she goes against Din instead of helping him, that would make me really sad because I'm really loving, especially the interpretation now in live action, having the same actress performing the role. It just makes mm-hmm. it so much more complete and so much feels to you like you're watching some Clone Wars as well. So I really don't want her to become the bad guy, but I wouldn't be against it. And honestly, they're exploring way more complex characters this season. And mm-hmm. we'll get to it, obviously, now when we talk about the second storyline that was happening. Mm-hmm. But complicated people with complicated motivations that are not necessarily easy to understand are really fun to watch. So I don't know why people complain when this happens and they want, what, linear characters that don't step outside the lines and do the same thing every time. Is that what we want? I don't want that.
True, true. Can't argue with that. Especially, I mean, we definitely need to know like how it happens, because I think the problem some people have with that type of thing is the how, which is what you were getting at what happened with season 8 on Game of Thrones. It's just that we didn't take the time to explore how that could happen in a way that makes more sense cohesively with how the rest of the show has been structured. Right.
Which is what happened with the prequels, because there were gaps that we felt like, how did they get from that point to this point in those three movies? And then we got the animated Clone Wars and it filled in the gaps. And like we were talking, I think, in the last Bad Batch episode, is that Bad Batch is doing that for the sequel trilogy. And now so is Mando. If we want to go to the second storyline now, we are filling the gaps of really how easy it was for the New Republic to fail.
Yep. And this is going to be like the final piece so that we can bridge the gap now into the second part. People were saying online that this episode was kind of like, oh, see how Mando likes it, like what they did to Boba Fett in the Book of Boba Fett, where he's not even in his own show. And it's like, did we watch a different show? Mando started the cold open and then ended the show. So he was in the show. And
the dogfight was amazing, by the way.
The dog was, oh. Yeah, just as good as anything we've seen in any of the films. But everything, like, I can't understand the argument of the Mando episodes in Book of Boba, because in a way they were self-contained episodes of The Mandalorian instead of like what happened in this episode. Everything that was happening with Dr. Pershing and Elia Kane
is going to affect what's happening to the main storyline.
Exactly, it might not be Mando, but it's characters that we've seen before, and that, like you just said, like it literally is moving the plot forward from what we saw in season 2 and into where the show is heading. And it was, I don't understand how people, one, can call it filler, and then two, how people can just say like, oh, this is just a Book of Boba Fett type episode type of thing, because it's like none of the above. Like, I don't understand how people are watching the show, if they just want to like hate on it just because, like you said at the beginning, fans just refuse to be happy. They just want to live in a perpetual state of misery.
sameness.
With Star Wars.
Well, and if it's to the same, then they complain. They complain that it's to the same. So you can never satisfy them. I think season 3 of The Mandalorian so far has been excellent.
Yep, yep. Oh,
it was way better than I was expecting. Yes, better than season 2. And we don't usually like to do comparisons, but that is the reality. It's way better than season 2 so far. And honestly, we're just getting started.
And this is very interesting because it feels a little bit like 2 episodes just because
it does,
of the different tonalities between like the Mando plot line with Bo and then the Dr. Pershing stuff. So now let's go into the second part of this episode with Dr. Pershing. What a welcome surprise. We head back to, we're in the Coruscant or whatever you want to call it, the Renaissance of Coruscant. Oh my God, we can't stop going.
And how different did it look from what it looked like in Andor?
And correctly so, because it was framed in, as opposed to Andor, it's just like the brutality of the Empire. Yeah. So we have to show how.
And it was like a lot of gray and functionality.
It's brutalist architecture. It's very deconstructivist, and it's very gray and depressing and oppressive. And now it's like the Empire has been defeated. Coruscant is like now again the Coruscant of the days of the Old Republic. It's bright. It's beautiful. Delicious. I loved it so much. I love the prequel love, because then we see the opera house from Revenge of the Sith in the same shots. And I was just like, oh, man.
I know. What are you doing to me? Yeah.
I'm like, this is the great thing that Mando has been doing, bridging those gaps.
And the amazing thing is that you see this like Old Republic Coruscant, but none of its problems have been resolved. Corruption is rampant. They never weeded out the problem. It's like, you know, the aristocrats are there kind of like, oh, Empire, Republic, it's all the same to us because we're full of money and we just, you know, we're not really affected by anything that's happening. So, change in political party. It's what they felt like it was.
It's one of those things that's so real life type of things, right?
Right.
It's one of the things where change in political parties, changes in governments, all these things like don't affect two people. The ultra poor, because let's face it,
they're going to be oppressed regardless.
The governments never take care of the very poor people in our society, and for them, all those changes mean nothing because the governments never do anything for them. And then two, for the ultra wealthy, change doesn't matter for them either because they'll be fine regardless. And it's one of those things where you see the hypocrisy, right, of the ultra rich, where it's just like it doesn't matter. And it ties back into Last Jedi too, and we're at Canto Bight and we see DJ talk about like how the rich don't care because they make a profit out of selling weapons to the bad guys or the good, and that's just a point of view for them. It's incredible. And again, we tie it with Andor with the dinner scene where they're just talking about like whatever happens
parties,
we're gonna be fine. Exactly. We're gonna be having our dinner parties, we're gonna go to the space opera all the same. So it's just like a great thing that we've been talking how the tonalities between Andor and Mandalorian are completely different and they should be different, but I really appreciate this episode because it shows that just because they're different doesn't mean that we can't talk about similar things and bridge gaps a little bit, because even though people have said that this sequence, right, the Pershing sequence of the episode was an Andor episode, I'll push back against that to an extent.
Yeah,
it's Andor-esque, right, in terms of like it's noir, it's a little mystery, it's a cloak and dagger type of thing, but it still has like the wonder and the fantasy of Mandalorian. Still feels very Attack of the Clones. It's like a baby
and Clone Wars.
In Clone Wars.
Yeah, yes. Because in Clone Wars was the first one that we really got to see like both sides of the story as they were happening. Like we'd get Count Dooku episodes mixed in with like the good guy episodes and everything. So it's always really, they started saying that was like new to Andor, but that's not true. Mm-hmm. Andor did it very well, but it has been done before, and Mando just did it really well in this episode as well, to see behind the curtain to what's happening in Coruscant. And to see what's happening...
Let's say something, you said Coruscant, and for me, one of the most incredible things that I never thought I would see in live action was I don't know how to pronounce it, I'm sorry, Umate, Umate, how did they say it in the show? The peak The Monument Plaza.
I see. I don't know how to pronounce
when
it.
When we saw that, I was just like, because I had, I mean, I didn't remember actually that. I didn't remember.
Yeah.
And so, sorry, nerds. I didn't remember that it was in the Clone Wars. I totally forgot about it. It's too many episodes. I can't keep track of them all. But I more recently remember from Light of the Jedi, the new one of the High Republic books, when they're talking about Monument Plaza. And all of a sudden, when we see that, and all of a sudden, I see the mountain, and he's like, oh, crap. Are they doing live action Monument Plaza with Umate, the peak? The tallest peak of Coruscant. I was like, thank you. This is you're hitting like all my heartstrings. It's just beautiful. And then to cap it all off with then the scrap yards with the torn down Star Destroyer. I was just like,
oh my God, how gorgeous was that?
You're doing everything right. Like this episode's just doing it. Like it's been season 3 is batting 1,000 right now. It's been like every single episode has been excellent, and it just keeps building and building and building, and I'm just loving it.
Well, and how amazing was it that they keep like adding into this connection of the Empire with Nazi Germany and stuff with what they basically were doing, Project Paperclip, with bringing in scientists and engineers and people from the Empire into asylum through that project that they brought in Dr. Pershing. So it's,
but it's a little different, and they had because like they don't let him do the thing. Right, because in Paperclip, you got all those Nazi scientists kind of work at NASA doing their thing.
And the Manhattan Project and everything else.
But this dude, this poor dude, Dr. Pershing, just, you know, he's just pusher. Yeah.
That's why there were so many red herrings, because you thought they were doing full Project Paperclip. And then you find out that they're trying to, like, weed them out. And Katie O'Brien, what's her character's name? Elia Kane. Oh, my God.
So good.
She was fantastic.
God bless her. I was so excited to have her back. It's just that little
I was not expecting that.
I was just like, we need more of her. And we got it. And exactly. It was one of those things where you didn't know who was the who. Right? Because at first you think that it's Dr. Pershing that's still evil, wanting to do the DNA thing. And she was the one that was reformed. And then it's just like, wait, what if it's her? Okay, what if it's both? And then it's just like that.
The whole episode.
That ended.
The whole entire episode, you're kind of like hypothesizing a million things. And then somebody says something different. It's like, oh no, it's this. And it keeps you in tension the whole entire episode. I have no idea how people did not enjoy this episode, because I was just like at the edge of my seat the whole time. Like, who is the actual bad guy here?
Did you think that Pershing was bad, or did you think that he was good?
I think he's just a great character as well, because I don't think he had bad intentions. I think he really does think that his genetic research is going to help in the long run. But again, he does it selfishly because that's his area of interest. He never said no to all the resources he got from the Empire, even after he found out what the Empire was doing was not good.
Right.
So I think at the end of the day, he didn't think of himself as a bad guy, but he probably was promoting bad guy things.
I think he's like, I forgot the character's name, but BD Wong in Jurassic Park, the scientist.
The scientist.
Who becomes like evil in Jurassic World and stuff like that. Not that version of him. Just the original Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
It's just like the one guy trying to do like genetic research to like do little dinosaurs, and it's just the counter, right, to, or the person that Jeff Goldblum's character actually talks about. It's like, your scientists were so worried about whether they could, and they forgot to ask whether they should, type of person. And I think
broke all ethics to just try to get your job done, which is basically what he was doing. He was saying, oh, the ethics of it doesn't really matter if the result is important. And I think the result of my research is in the long run going to be good, which is how they trap him so well.
Oppenheimer, dude, atomic bomb dude. You know, it's just like he thought his research was about
was for the common good and
completely different. And all of a sudden, she's like, "Bam! It's a new I am death, destroyer of worlds," and type of thing. And I think that's kind of the whole that Pershing found himself in, and the thing that he was almost reformed out of to an extent. And then Elia Kane beautifully manipulates him into falling into that, and like, and using the pureness, right, of his desires and his
wants. Oh, it's because you want it to change. It's not about the Empire. It's about this. But that's also like cognitive reinforcement, though. Whatever she was saying to him made him acknowledge, oh, right, it wasn't about the Empire. It's because I thought my episode was good. And it makes you forget about all the bad things that the Empire did. So she clearly entrapped him.
But
he was, you know, telling himself that it was okay to do it as well. So she definitely entrapped him, which made me think that she was just part of like this like undercover job to discover who was still Empire. Well,
she is.
But it was more than that.
But she's a triple agent.
But it was more than that. I thought it ended there. And then what do we find out?
Triple agent,
she is
baby.
Just pissed. She's just pissed.
No, she's working for Moff Gideon.
Oh, my God.
I mean, that's how I understood it. She was frying his brain to destroy the evidence. She's working for
him. Claro, pero I actually saw it as, this is the way I read it, and we're going to find out who was right or wrong. I saw it as she was taking out her revenge on people who joined the Empire voluntarily because she didn't have a choice about it.
No, I think she's a triple agent. She's a bad guy. She's still working with Moff Gideon. She's infiltrating the amnesty program. And she intentionally was targeting Pershing so that she could get him there in the mind flare.
But what about all the conversations about, oh, you did it because you wanted to. I never had a choice.
So that's called manipulate. She's a triple agent. She's manipulating him into trusting her so that they're finding that common ground. So she's lying. She's lying. She's a secret agent.
She is lying. But I think she's actually just out for revenge.
Bad guy. She's bad guy. She's working Gideon.
She is a bad guy regardless, but it was gloriously played. Regardless, it was.
I loved it. But I do hope that this is not the last that we see of Pershing. Like, I really liked him. Like, this is the first character This is the first time that we've get to live with him, right? Because we've seen him in season one.
So little.
Season
two.
But he's he shows up and he then leaves. And, you know, he's a recurring character. This is the first episode that we get to be with him, see his state of mind, see who he is, and finally empathize with him. And I would be very, very sad if this is it and the mind flayer just, you know,
totally destroyed him.
Destroyed, like
massive lobotomy.
Yep. Deep fried his brain into like a alcapurria or something. I truly hope that it's more like a Rogue One thing with Borg Gullet, where, you know, like Riz Ahmed's character with Borg Gullet, and it was supposed to destroy your brain, but then 5 minutes later he's like, I'm fine actually. I hope that this is what happens, that he's a little out of it for a couple minutes. Or maybe one episode, and then like he's like, "Oh no, I'm back!" And Elia Kane betrayed me. Now we have to go find her. I'm gonna join the good guys for real, real now, because I need him. I need him. I liked him a lot in this episode.
Yeah, no, he was great.
So was our girl Cady O'Brien.
She was fantastic.
She was amazing.
Yeah,
can't wait to see more. But as always, I mean, this is. I mean, I think we've covered like a lot of the episode. And we, as always, could be talking about it forever and ever. But now it's the part that everyone, or at least one person in the comments, thank you so much, I really appreciate you, likes, which is
responsible speculation.
Always responsible, and don't take it personally if it doesn't happen. Nani, I already heard what you think about Katie's character, Elia Kane. What do you think is going to happen? Like, what do you think is going to happen now? Either in next episode or the entirety, now that we have even more building blocks.
I feel like I have less building blocks because every single time I watch a new episode, it destroys everything that I was expecting that was going to happen next. So it's actually really hard to speculate at this point. I think we're definitely going to see more of interactions like Bo-Katan, Din, and the rest of the Watch. And see those crazy dynamics and how they happen. I still kind of really want like a Bo-Katan Din training session with the Darksaber.
Kind of like the
Sabine and
Kanan and Sabine.
And I have no idea. I have no idea what we're gonna get. There was a mention of Boba Fett in a previous episode as well. So who knows if that's out of the table for Boba Fett to show up.
He'll come back.
In an episode?
He'll come back. Yes.
And I know. And there are so much implications to everything that was going on in Coruscant. So I kind of really want to see more of these flaws or whatever is going on behind the scenes in the New Republic that, you know, you watch it and you're like, wow, it's just, it's so ready to fail.
I agree. And from the trailers, we know that Carson Teva is going to be back this season. So now by you saying that, like, my brain starting to speculate responsibly. And like, I'm thinking that maybe if not next episode, like maybe it's the one immediately after, but to me, it makes sense that next episode he shows up because there's an investigation into what happened to Pershing. Because they're going to discover him. Yeah. And it's like, what the hell, man? Like, this was our prime dude. And now his brain is fried. What's happening? And then Leia Kane's going to disappear. She's going to disappear because she's going to run away. She's going to go back to find Gideon. So now Carson Teva, because he says, I forgot verbatim what Carson Teva says in the trailer, but it's something along the lines of like, something's happening. And if we don't do something about it, it's going to get out of control. Something along those lines is what he says. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, he figures out that there's a plot to, you know, that's behind the scenes and he sees it, but no one else in Coruscant is seeing it. Because the New Republic just wants to be like, oh, no, everything's fine.
Yeah, we're done. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wouldn't be against showing like the origins of the First Order, which we're kind of starting to see some glimpses of. And I like it when they kind of close the gaps and.
Yeah, do it. Especially if it's done well, right? And right now, it's delicious. My thing, though, now is especially with how Bad Batch is going. Yeah, where we've seen Mount Tantus twice. Yeah. We're also talking about cloning and that, which I don't know if this was like a intentional thing of like having these episodes kind of overlap. But then when Pershing is talking about all the cloning thing and he makes a point to talk about the Kaminoans, I'm just like, oh my God, does this mean that, you know, that there's synergy here with Bad Batch and Mando? And does that mean my crazy mind now saying, are we going to see Mount Tantus in live action?
God,
like, is it gonna be, because if everyone is saying that the Mandoverse is gearing up to do like an adaptation of Timothy Zahn's Heir to the Empire is where we see Mount Tantus for the first time in the expanded universe. So does that mean that it's going to connect to Ahsoka somehow and we have to go to Mount Tantus? And obviously there's the cloning stuff there that leads to the Snoke thing and then the First Order, but then like somehow there's the Bat Batches armor is in Tantus because their cadavers are there because they die at the end of season 2.
God.
And we see them here in Mandalore. It's like, I don't know if we're going to Mount Tantus in season 3, but I think that based on what we're seeing, and if we want to, and if this whole rumor of Heir to the Empire is true, then it kind of makes sense that like Mando season 3, or
and if we're closing all these gaps and
eventually ends up in Mount Tantus. I'm not going to say Exegol. Maybe Exegol is for Ahsoka. No, it doesn't make sense for them to go to Exegol because Exegol, you can only go with the Pathfinders, which should have been holocrons, by the way. But I'm going too crazy. Stop me. Wrap up the show. This is
nothing's crazier than your fly.
It was good.
It was great.
Didn't happen, but it was good.
Happened, but we'll see. There's still so much to happen for the Mandalorian. It's really hard to speculate because it really has been exceeding my expectations for this season. And it's always been surprising. Mm-hmm. So
for better or for worse.
So we'll see. Don't make Bo-Katan the bad guy. Don't.
No.
But please. Okay. Okay. Well, anyway, I think we're done today, right?
Unfortunately. But thankfully, this week, everyone gets two Try out the Force Mando episodes because we were late last week. So no episodes last week. Actually, you got a Bad Batch episode last week, but now you get two Mando episodes. Mm-hmm. So wait until Friday when we hopefully get back on schedule and we can release episodes as it was intended. So yes, until then.
Until then, we are Triad of the Force. Remember to like, subscribe, leave a comment, join our responsible speculations.
Yes, please.
Leave us some comments. We love it. I know the comments. Come on, please. Come up with some crazy stuff.
Boost the algorithm. Come on, guys.
We will be around with another episode of The Mandalorian because another episode comes out on Wednesday. We are continuing to cover Bad Batch, which is getting really interesting at the end as well. And we love you all. May the Force be with you.